But I started to have this really horrible churning feeling in my stomach that I should go back upstairs or that I should go. Just the word go kept coming in my head. It was almost like they were taking my life and soul from me. I couldn't do anything about it.
Welcome to another episode of On the Edge with Andrew Gold. I've got Nina Oulk, that is A-O-U-I-L-K, Oulk, and she's going to tell us one of the most harrowing stories I've ever heard, and every time you think it's over, it's still worse. And she is just an absolute, I suppose, a tribute to the, or an homage to the human spirit, and how she's able to be such a wonderful and eloquent and interesting person today, who is very much helping other people who have been through situations like hers, which I will explain, well, a little bit, and you can hear it, I guess. But she grew up in a Punjabi, which is part, you know, a culture from India, a Punjabi family in the UK. She'll explain this, and she just had, you know, the worst father and family, I think, one of the worst I've ever heard, quite frankly. And I felt angry and sad the whole way through this. I've just finished recording it, actually. And I think you'll feel that way too, but it's something that needs to be heard, I believe. And I'll have, there are all sorts of links, you know, as to how you can help her to spread the word and help other people who are in situations like the one she was in. Those will be in the show notes. And yeah, there's not much more to say about it, because it's just, I having just finished the interview, I feel in a very strange, somber mood right now. So I don't know. Keep watching the episode, patreon.com/AndrewGoles, where you get it all without ads, and you get the Saturday episodes as well. But now you're on the edge of a horrible, horrible story with Nina Oulk. Nina, how are you doing?
I'm amazing. Thank you for asking.
Oh, well, that's good. That's a great start. We're going to get into some quite negative things, but it's good to hear that you're feeling positive now. Maybe we can obviously, you know, start at the beginning a little bit. What kind of family were you brought up in? And I mean that with respects to beliefs and religions and things like that.
Yeah, sure. I often say to people get it confused with religion. It's nothing to do with religion. I'm born into a family that is originally from North India, the Punjab to be exact. I'm British born, as you can maybe tell by my accent. So I'm born and bred here, but my culture immersed me with a certain type of way of life that I had to take on whether I wanted to or not, meaning that I wasn't accepted because I was born a girl. Boys, when they are born, are celebrated. There are huge parties, sweets are given out, which is traditional, really. And tradition should be about dancing, food. The culture should be about the clothes people wear, how they celebrate different festivities, but not really about gender-based violence or abuse and discrimination, which is what I faced.
That's really interesting. And it's not a religion. And yet we see so many of the similar kinds of things that we see in cults, religions, cultures, which I guess this is, it's more of a culture where the men are just celebrated and the women just don't get a say in anything and get treated badly. So was this to do with would you say Punjabi culture then?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, a lot of people, I get a lot of backlash. I've had a lot of, even this morning, I had somebody threatening that I need to stop speaking, that I'm speaking a lot of lies, which comes with when you start to stand in your own truth. But it is very cultural in the sense of it's the mentality that's passed from family to family, generational programming as well, that girls just don't mean anything, so you can treat them as you want. They're very almost disposable, I would use the word, because then they're not a very good or highly regarded person. They're very below. If there was a class system, they would be put right at the bottom of the pile. And I think that's what happens. And genders are a huge thing because the men are the, you know, the warriors and the women are the weak ones, but they're not protected often. However, having said that, women facilitate a lot of this programming, in the community, as I've seen in my own case and other people's cases that I'm helping with.
And before we get into your story then, I mean, how common is this? I don't mean to offend a lot of people in the Punjab community. I had a lot of friends who were part of that. Obviously, that's one of the main communities from sort of India area in the UK. How common is this, your story? How extreme is it compared to the average story of people from that community?
Well, a lot of people say to me, you know, I'm from this culture and I'm really sorry for what you've gone through. I've been interviewed by a few people from my culture and they've said, well, you know, nothing like that happened in my family. And I can tell very clearly they're lying. It might not be to the extreme that I've had to deal with, but the fact that there's a difference between a boy and a girl is always very clear, and that people actually know that's the fact. I was actually interviewed by a Punjabi, I think it's a magazine, a sort of a channel, and it took over 4 hours to record because the gentleman that was recording it and the other person that was recording it was also a Punjabi man, had to keep stopping. And I thought it was because they were being very disturbed by my story, but in fact they were reliving things they had seen themselves and faced, knowing they hadn't done anything about it. So although they might not have been the ones that had caused sexual abuse or domestic violence or discrimination, they had stood by and not done anything. And I always say, you're part of the problem, not the solution. If you do that, you're as much to blame. And because of that, they had a real traumatic time filming me. But, you know, I have to say to them, thank you for doing what they did, because they took a huge risk, again, with a lot of backlash. But they wanted to get it out there, and I think that was their way of putting it right, possibly. So it's very common, and anyone listening to this who's Punjabi might sort of say, oh, she's talking nonsense. And that's okay, because I'm the one getting the messages from people from my community and communities like it in 2023 saying, I'm 13 years old, my dad hates me, treats me really badly, brothers are allowed to do things and I'm just not allowed to do anything and I hate my life.
I got a shiver down my spine when you talked about the guys realizing what they'd been a part of. That's such an effective thing to imagine. And we've all in very small ways had moments like that as well. And it's really, really effective. Let's go into your story. So from a young age, I've heard your mother didn't want you to be picked up by other people. Why was that?
Yeah, it's a common thing, isn't it? When someone has a baby, you all go around and coo over the baby and pick them up. I mean, I know that's how my children were celebrated by any guest that we had at the time. But for me, it was a very solemn affair, apparently. You know, I'm only going by what people have told me in secrecy. But they've told me that nobody was allowed to touch me. You know, I was seen as an evil spirit. And Asians and Africans believe in this whole concept that there are sometimes children that come onto the earth that are holding an evil spirit, or they are bewitched, or that they are possessed. And I apparently was that person, because I'd broken the continuation of boys being born. And because of me, they said that other girls were born in the family. So I was that bad omen that said nobody would touch me because they felt they might get something from me in that respect. So I was left in my pushchair, my pram, I suppose it was then, for days without being fed or changed. And I had a soiled nappy, but I learned to sort of just calm myself, I guess. And I think that's gone through life with me. I'm very able to sort of just calm myself and let things go. I knew nobody was coming to save me. And I think I knew that from a young age.
Just to get inside their heads for a minute then, and if that's even possible to do. So they don't want a girl to be born. It's broken the line of boys, but there has to be women. There have to be 50% of women for the whole thing to work. So how does this work in their minds?
Yeah, I mean, I can't get into people's heads and I don't even try to understand them. You know, people say, why do you think your mum and dad did this? And I say, well, I'm not them. I won't understand you either, Andrew. So, you know, we're all individuals and unique to our own thoughts and concepts. All I can say is that there is a problem. There's a problem in Asia because there's not enough girls being born. So the older men are taking younger girls because they have a better job. They have, you know, that ability, but that also brings in paedophilia and child abuse, because girls are being almost traded by their parents as young as 14, which again is another issue that I deal with, you know, I campaign against. But there's visual recognition and statistics that this is a problem. This is a problem not just in India. It's a problem in lots of other countries around Asia and the Middle East, where there's a lack of girls. I mean, I was talking to somebody today who told me in a particular village, it's known in the Punjab to kill girls once they're born, which meant that the whole village only had babies that were boys, so boy children, which meant that the only way they could overcome that is to bring girls in. But nobody wanted their girls to be married into this village, because they knew that if they did, and the daughter should have a daughter, that she may also be killed as well as her daughter because she's providing a girl child.
Oh my God. That's insane. I suppose then it's that everybody does actually want daughters to be born, but just not into their own families.
I'm not sure that they do, which, you know, I can't get it round my head, because I know Hindus, they celebrate daughters. They see them as an extension of one of their goddesses, you know, and she brings wealth and light, which is beautiful. But I also know a lot of Hindus that are not happy because they've never had a boy. Which, you know, I know English families that I know a girl that used to live near me when I was living in Leicestershire, and she had boy after boy after boy, the most gorgeous boys you can, you know, they're beautiful. And she was white Caucasian. Her husband at the time was from the Afro-Caribbean, but she desperately wanted a girl. And I can understand she kept trying for that girl, but she wouldn't ever get rid of any of her boys or treat them differently. And that's the difference. People say, oh, it happens in lots of cultures, but this is a need for a boy to carry on the, you know, the line of the family name and the whole keeping the wealth within the family. They don't want the family's wealth to go with the girl because she then belongs to another family. So I think that's where it derives from.
Yeah, that's insane. Right. So, and then your early years, then you were sort of put to work.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't realize any of this until I came out of everything a couple of years ago, and I was speaking to a nonprofit I work with, who work with human trafficking victims and survivors, so that we can enable them to get back into life in society, because they're so, their reality is so warped and distorted, you know, they don't know how to do it. And it was through that training and through speaking to the lady that runs that nonprofit called Youth Underground, that she really enabled me to see life how it was for me, that I was a modern day slave at the age of 6. You know, I was not allowed to integrate with the family. I wasn't allowed to speak to the family. It was all very nonverbal communication. My room wasn't soft furnishings. It wasn't full of toys or bedding. It was breeze blocks, because it was a brand new extension, purpose-built room. And I was kept, there was a huge room, don't get me wrong, but there was nothing there. The walls were bare. The beds were bare. The bed was bare. I had a cardboard box of my clothes that I would wear to school. And I used to just fill it with books, because I used to bring books from school. But I never sat on the sofa to watch television with my brothers. I never stood in the kitchen and chatted with my mother at making tea. The only times I came out of that room is when I was called upon, and there were three basic words: cook, clean. The come meant there was another task for me to do, whether it was laundry or something had spilled or somebody had visited and they wanted tea making. But I was literally like a little servant. And for me, it was normality. So if you don't know any different, you're happy with it. And I was happy. You know, I would look forward. But I remember no end of times getting splinters in the top of my ears, because I used to literally push my head against the very harsh wooden door and rubbing it as you do as a child, trying to listen really carefully to what's going on, feeling really out of it, not part of my family unit, which I desperately wanted to be. I would listen, thinking, oh, I can hear them walking. I can hear them sneezing. That's my brother who sneezed. And when they would laugh at a television show, I would laugh, feeling almost like with my eyes closed, I was sat with them. And as a young child, you know, you don't understand these things. You don't know about the neglect. But it was most definitely there.
It's just the saddest image. It's just so sad. And that people would do that to people. Did you get an idea that things were different for other people just from being at school, for example, of reading all these books?
Well, my father moved us to a very white predominant area from Birmingham. And the reason being, I think he quite enjoyed the fact nobody saw him from the community, so he could do what he wanted also. In hindsight, I didn't see that at the time, but he was having extramarital affairs. He was dating women not from our culture. So if there's nobody around to catch him out, he's going to continue doing what he wanted to do. So we lived a double life. And within that area, we went to a school that's predominantly white British. There was myself, my brother, and another girl later on in school, in a higher school. But in primary, it was just myself and my brother. So we would be continuously bullied, spat upon. You know, I remember my hair being pulled and they would say ding dong and calling me all sorts of racial names. And I would, you know, particularly be scared of a boy whose name was Brownie, which is quite funny because, you know, of the fact it's a colour and I was that colour skin. And he would really make my life hell. And I used to wish I was him. I used to sit there and think, I wish I was you because, you know, no one says anything to you and you're white and you're a boy, so you must be really loved. And I started to read dislike and almost sort of bordered hate, which is a very strong word, myself, because of the skin I was born into, the life I was born into, and the way I was treated externally and internally in the house. I saw myself as that bewitched problem, that person who's not good enough, that person who's ugly and fat and all of these things. And that was my perception. But only recently somebody sent me a message and I had a conversation with her who lived literally two streets away from me. And she said, I remember you really clearly. And I said, I don't remember you. I'm very sorry. And she said, well, we'll remember you because you would come to the temple, sit at the back on your own. And you were really pretty. You had very long hair. It was always very shiny and you always looked really nice. And I thought, wow, that really changes my whole perception of how I was seen by the world. I thought nobody would sit with me because I was dirty and ugly, like the way my parents had described me to me. I was holding onto their words. And yet there's a girl telling me she's a couple of years younger than me and she wouldn't come and sit with me because I was too pretty or my hair was too long. And they thought they couldn't sit with me because I was almost too good for them. So it's really sometimes as a child, you don't realize how much someone else's voice and words imprint on you, what you think of yourself. And even as humans, as adults, it's the same thing.
I often ask this just because it's a question that really interests me, which is, what does this say to you about the idea or the concept of the paternal or maternal instinct when parents can, and so often in these kinds of cultures and things and different religions and cults and whatever it might be, treat their children in this such a way?
Well, the effects of that?
Well, just like, does it exist, the paternal, that sort of paternal love, I suppose, that instinctual, that people say is just nothing can break a bond between a mother and a daughter or a son, and then these kinds of stories happen.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I mean, as a mother now, I can't understand it. And I had a conversation with somebody who did an interview with me recently who had a threatening phone call from the town that I was born. You know, somebody had rang through and said, why are you broadcasting this nonsense? She's a liar. She's a, you know, a prostitute and the rest of it. Why are you doing the, you know, why are you allowing her to be on your respectful channel? And I said to him, I never really quite understood why my mother was so full of hatred and anger towards me. You know, and I sort of went through a bit of a mind mapping thing with him, trying to understand it. And then I said to him at the end of it, you know, I'll never know. It's just, I wanted to know what your opinion is. Because I think as children, we all want to be loved. As humans, we all want that innate ability to be loved and to give love. But in my culture, there's a lot of anger. There's a lot of hostility. It's a very aggressive culture. People from outside of our culture see our culture as very loving, that we're very giving, that we welcome people in and we feed them and we give them lots of drinks. And, you know, our weddings are known to be a huge party. But when you're living in something, that's the only time you actually know what it's like. And it wasn't fun for me.
Yeah, I just cannot fathom it. That's why I always ask that question to people, because I don't get what's happened to parents. Like, no matter how brainwashed someone might be or how enthralled to their culture they might be, that they could treat their children this way. Because you were basically a servant for years in the home. And I suppose, I mean, should we get to it? There was a moment in particular with your dad and his friends. Are you able to talk about that?
Hey, it's Andrew. If you're enjoying Heretics, there's another podcast I want to recommend to you, especially if climate change, global conflicts, and an upcoming election are making you feel like we're on the brink of disaster. What Could Go Right is hosted by Progress Network founder Zachary Carabel and executive director Emma Varvalukas. On What Could Go Right, the hosts sit down with expert guests to discuss the world's most pressing issues without resorting to pessimism or despair that we hear so often. Instead, they look back at how far society has come and look forward at what it will take to achieve an even brighter future. Is progress on the way? They may not have all the answers, but on What Could Go Right, they're asking the key questions. Tune in to hear interviews with upcoming guests like writer Coleman Hughes, CNN host Fareed Zakaria, and economist Alison Schrager. If you're looking for a weekly dose of optimistic ideas from smart people, join them every Wednesday on What Could Go Right, available wherever you get your podcasts.
actually started speaking about this about 3 years ago. And the reason I started speaking about it is because someone wanted to get into a relationship with me. He'd flown from quite a far distance to come and meet me. It's all very romantic when you talk about it, but I wasn't really looking for that relationship. And he thought there was a block on my part because where he lives, a lot of women are, you know, really ready to be in a relationship with him. So he found it a little bit almost, maybe his ego was speaking, but he said something that was very impactful on my life. And he said that something would have happened in your past that's caused you to be so closed off for wanting to be in a relationship. You know, and I sort of answered that the fact I'd just come out of a 23-year relationship with someone who was very violent, didn't love me, and I didn't know how to have a relationship because I never dated anyone in my life. You know, as a child, I didn't have a date. We didn't even speak to boys. We weren't allowed. And then I'd got into this arranged marriage, per se, and then I'd left that, gone to somebody for refuge and ended up in a relationship. And I never really had anyone ask me on a date or take me on a date or take me to dinner, treat me in that manner. And that's really important for you to learn about relationships in themselves, about what you do and don't like in a person, how people act and what you maybe do that people don't like as well. So you can also check in with yourselves. But I hadn't had that. So for someone to say these things to me, I thought, I don't know what he's on about, and closed off and, you know, friend zoned him. And we are friends, we're really good friends. But I actually then went into a little bit of a deep dive in my own mind to find out what it was that I had buried so deeply that was causing me to not want to be intimate or want to have a relationship with anybody. And I had to admit the truth to myself, which is really painful because certain things you just want to put into a box and never open them again because they cause so much of a conflict within. And this particular thing made me feel dirty. It made me feel cheap. It made me feel like it was all my fault. It made me feel like I was lesser of a person, that everyone would look upon me and be ashamed of me and almost look down upon me to think that, oh, you know, because of what's happened, she's, you know, look at me in a certain way. And this is when I was concerned about what people thought. But I unfortunately, when I got to the age of 14, one of my jobs was to cook for my father's friends when he would come over. Alcohol really changes people. And when my father would bring his friends over from the pub, you know, on a Friday night, they'd go to the pub, or a Saturday, they would sit and drink in our house. We, you know, my dad had a pub, so he had lots of alcohol. It was part of his business. He was the pub owner. And they would come and they would drink until the early hours of the morning. I was used to it. This is something I was doing from the age of 7 or 8. I can remember it clearly. All these people would come over. I would call them uncle, but they weren't related. But we don't say people's names in my culture. So out of respect to an elder, which is the same in Africa too, in a lot of other countries, we say uncle or auntie. And they would come over. I recognized them by their sounds because I was nonverbal. I wouldn't look up because of ours. We are taught as girls to keep our eyes really down, our heads down. So I would never dare to make eye contact. And on this particular night, and I talk about this a lot, about this internal messaging service that we have in our bodies that click, click, clicks us all the time. It's almost like, you know, the olden days where you see those movies and you have the operator and she's connecting the telephone lines into a ball of sockets almost. I feel our bodies, we're literally energy, and our bodies connecting those sockets almost to tell us how we should and shouldn't feel. But within those sockets is also a warning system. And that warning system is that shiver that you have down your spine. It's when you get goosebumps. It's when your heart starts to race. It's when that churningness comes into your stomach. And that's what I had that night. I was waiting for them to finish their food, to clear up. And I was sat down, you know, in my pajamas, playing around with my slipper. I'd kicked it too far and I was trying to bring it in. And I could hear them shouting and laughing and joking. They had some music on. There were bottles on the outside. Johnny Walker whiskey is what they were drinking. There were like 3 or 4 bottles. And I thought, they're really drunk today. But I started to have this really horrible churning feeling in my stomach that I should go back upstairs or that I should go. Just the word go kept coming in my head. But I couldn't go anywhere. I had no option but to go in there and pick up the dishes. And I went in with a tray because I had this huge tray and I was only a small child. I was quite a small girl at that time. And the tray was taken from me from my father and thrown. I didn't know why he'd snatched it. I didn't look up. And I just remember keeping my eyes really tightly shut. And it was my father that was the first to rip down my pajama bottoms and start to rape me, you know. But I always say that it wasn't just a rape. It was a really frenzied attack. Like, they were proving themselves to each other that they were biting me. You know, the other day, and by telling this, I literally open up a wound to help others to heal. But at the same time, I start to remember other things. And I remembered my tongue being bitten, and I've never said that before. You know, and I remember almost feeling, I almost felt paralyzed, you know, paralyzed to the point where I couldn't move. And I always felt my body wasn't my body because everyone was taken. And I could smell them. I could hear them. You know, a lot of horrible things were done to me. And I was passed from person to person. I was thrown onto the floor because my father had thrown me onto the table. I remember having food near my legs. I can remember, the feeling of warm food still. The glass was broken. All sorts was going on. And some of them left, but some of them stayed. And the ones that stayed just repeatedly raped me or sexually abused me and punched me. You know, there was a lot of punching going on. And I was a young 14-year-old child who wasn't really able to defend herself. I didn't cry. I was scared to cry because I thought if I cry, they're going to hit me more. I was almost internally dying, slowly but surely. It was almost like they were taking my life and soul from me. I couldn't do anything about it. And I either passed out or fell asleep, and I'm guessing it was passed out, to wake up to my mum, who made noise with the door by slamming it and opening it to waken me, not coming in to check if I was okay. And I remember that I couldn't move properly. My legs hurt, you know, my private parts hurt, everything hurt. I remember glancing downwards because I couldn't look up towards my mum, and I saw bite marks all along my right arm. You know, I was bleeding from my arm. I was bleeding from my different areas. And when I looked down, I had no pajama bottoms on. My top was torn. My hair had blood in it and all sorts of stuff, semen, I'm guessing. And I was literally laying in a bath of my own blood. And I didn't know what to do. I was trying to get up, and I did get up, and the first thing I thought about was the plates are broken and there's food on the wall, and I'm really going to be in trouble now because I have to clean this up. And my mother allowed me to have a shower, because I was never allowed to shower. I was allowed to have bucket baths, as they're called, where you fill up a bucket and have a jug. My brothers were allowed a shower. I never was, but she allowed me to have a shower. And I remember the feeling of the water on my skin. It was almost like a motherly feeling, that the water was my mother washing me, because I'd never had that as a child. And I went downstairs, and I remember clearing up. And then asking my mother, who had given me my brother's old pajamas, and asking her if I could sleep, because my body was exhausted. I was physically and mentally so tired that I just needed to lay down. And I was in bed for days with a lot of pain. And I think I had a fever at one point. You know, I became quite poorly. But I remember her telling me after a couple of days, you've got to go to school. And I think she wanted me to carry on with my duties as the servant, I guess, which is what I did. But life for me really changed at 14. I lost that happy-go-lucky, innocent child. And I was robbed of my innocence, I guess. They had stolen a lot from me.
I really am so sorry that you went through that, Nina. It's just... it just angers me hearing it. I'm sorry to hear that. You didn't deserve that, and nobody does. It's just the worst thing, the ultimate betrayal. Did you get any sense that your mum, I suppose, aside from letting you have a shower, that she felt bad for you for what happened?
No, my mum was very angry with me. And I always learn about things when I was speaking to other victims and survivors and, you know, always reflect, because I think that's life, isn't it? We reflect on other people's stories. That's how we learn about situations and how people get through, like myself. And one lady was telling me that her mum saw her as a threat. And I wondered whether my mum saw me as a threat, you know, because not to my own perception of me, but other people's perception of me having learned this, was that I was quite pretty. I was quite a good girl. You know, I looked like a nice girl. So maybe she didn't like that. I don't know. But again, I'll never know. And that's okay, because I don't need to know. You know, I've made peace with it.
And it's so frustrating, though, because she could have formed an alliance with you in this patriarchal household, you know?
Well, even if she was scared, which a lot of people say, and I believe that, you know, to a certain degree, she would be scared. I believe more so that she was so influenced by my father and his aggressive nature and his family being aggressive, that she lost compassion. And I feel there's no compassion within Asian families for their children. They don't hold their children, do they? They don't speak to their children with a loving manner. They almost treat their children like the children owe to them. They owe their lives to them because they were born from them. So the children always have this guilt that they carry, which is a heavy, heavy burden, that we must please our parents. We must do this for our parents. We must make sure that our parents don't see us cry, because crying is weak and we don't show emotion. And even now, you know, young men that I speak to, it's the same situation, that they hold a stiff upper lip, as the British say. But it's very relevant, because they don't want to be seen as weak. But I feel it's within your weakest times you find your true strengths, as I have.
Yeah, no, you absolutely have. And it's really a lesson to people about human resilience, what you're doing now and how inspiring it is. It really is something. I can't believe it's all, and I don't, you know, all Asian families. I just want to be careful, because a lot of people will view this, and there's, I even know Asian families who, I mean, they seem very, very secular, so to speak, and you know, but I can understand. Is it more that there's a sort of this prevalent culture?
No, I'm a very proud Indian. You know, I'm British born Indian. I'm very proud. I'm not attacking my culture. I'm not attacking India or the people that live within India. I'm not attacking the Middle East. I'm not attacking people from Pakistan or Africa. I'm not attacking any particular community or culture. You know, cult, it is a cult. What I'm attacking is the way that women are treated with gender-based violence, and also addressing that a lot of this is to do with other people and how they see our families and how they see us. And even men suffer in that whole keeping up the appearance. You know, they're suffering. They're not in situations that they want to be in. They're not in love with their partners. A lot of them won't get a divorce because it was an arranged marriage, because their parents won't like it. A lot of them will just exist in life and never really have what I've got, which is complete freedom. And complete freedom doesn't mean I get to go out clubbing, which is how they perceive a woman or a man says about freedom. It's about actually living the life my religion tells me to live, which is with complete love, to be of service to others, to not discriminate between people because of their color or their class system or their caste system, but just to see that we are all one, that you're a ball of energy and I'm energy wrapped up in this outfit that I'm wearing today, which is disguised as this face. But internally, you know, I'm just this accumulation of love, which I can pass on to you and the next person, that we don't have to hate one another. We can build one another up more if we acknowledge that we are all one and we're all the same.
What do you think's going on with your dad's friends who he had over the house? Because are they all just sitting around? And then does that imply there are groups of people right now sitting around having those kinds of conversations? I know it appears naive, but it's just so hard to imagine. And they're going, right, we'll go round and your daughter's going to be there and so on.
I don't think it was planned, if I'm being honest, because it never happened again. I don't think it was planned. I think it was a case of a group of men being very drunk. A lot of the girls I speak to that have been sexually abused by uncles or family members have always been abused when they've been around the age of 14, 15. And that's when a girl is starting to come into her womanhood. And I almost feel there's a primal, instinctive thing that men have where they almost sense it. And that attracts them to that female, which is wrong because it's at the end of the day, I was like a daughter to all of them because they were all a fatherly age to me. So I should never have been treated in that way it should never have just happened. There's no excuse for it and I don't condone it. But it happens a lot. And a lot of people from my culture that it happens to will speak out and ask their mums for help. And the mums will hush it away and say, don't talk about that. You know, things happen, but you mustn't say anything. But my issue was that I had lost my virginity and my parents knew that I couldn't get married to somebody without questions being asked. And apart from that, I ended up getting pregnant.
From that event?
From that event, I ended up getting pregnant. I mean, I wouldn't know who had impregnated me because there was 8 people there at the time. But I was taken to a private clinic. I was 15 and I had a procedure that, you know, an abortion procedure. I remember it very clearly. And I always say what I choose to remember is the lady that showed me compassion for the first time in my life from a stranger that made me question if I really was this evil spirit that my parents had described me to be, this bewitched person, because she touched my hair, she stroked it in a very motherly way. But that kindness left a huge mark on my life because I suddenly felt seen. I felt like I wasn't that dirty person. I felt that maybe, just maybe, I could be loved one day. Right.
And I that's so sad as well, just these little moments, but also moments of kindness outside. Did it give you, like you say, a bit of hope that other people were different outside your family, you could have that nicer life?
It wasn't the hope she gave me. It was just that fact, you know, human interaction is a huge thing. Even now with the way situations have been recently, people cross over the road. They don't even say hello to you. If they say hello to you, they hold a distance. Where we've lost that ability to love. I believe that love is just disappearing and the compassion's completely gone. For another person to extend a hand and touch you, there's a real healing in that in itself. There's a real connection. There's a real language which is unspoken. And we need that. We need that as humans to grow. And she had given me this extension of love without speaking, really. She'd given me a cup of tea with a biscuit, which, you know, I had to always have a cup of tea because of her. She made it my favorite drink. But what she didn't know that she did was she gave a child, a young woman, the belief that maybe she wasn't this horrible person, that she could be, you know, at one point even seen and loved and heard. Whereas I'd given up on life completely after the attack and the rape. I had given up on life. I didn't want to exist. I just didn't want to, you know, mentally I'd broken down and I was still very broken after the abortion. So she was like almost a glimmer of light in a very dark world that I lived.
Where were social services in all of this? Because they must have been alerted to the fact that you're getting this abortion and everything.
Well, I think school initially should have picked up the fact that I went from being a very able student, sat right at the front of the tables, you know, always keen to hand her homework and a people pleaser. Despite the fact I was being picked on, they should have picked up on the fact that I was no longer doing my homework. I was very withdrawn. I was sitting at the back now. Sometimes I would sit on the floor. And I think I was attention seeking looking back. I was almost crying out for help without saying help me, because it's so hard to say help me in case somebody says they can't or they don't want to. So that rejection again is what stops a lot of people saying I need help. But to ask for help, it takes a lot of courage. And as a young girl who didn't have a supportive family, had no friends, had nobody really around her, who would go to school neglected, you know, looking like she was neglected with matted hair and dirty clothes. I really need someone just to say, Nina, what's wrong? Because I would have opened up it would have been like opening a can of worms. I literally would have emptied that can of worms and threw away the can and said, this is my life, please do something. I can't take it anymore, because I was at that point, I couldn't.
And then just at that point, they sort of set you up to marry And it's not a real uncle. It was one of those uncle people, right?
Yeah. So one of the men that had stayed at the right at the end of the rape, who'd continuously raped me and bitten me, he was the person that was biting a lot. He came forward. My father was really upset because he said, we're never going to marry her off. Now we've had the abortion. That's even worse. You know, no one's going to want her. We'll have to send her to India maybe to marry somebody older there or just to get rid of her. They kept saying this word honour killing all the time. They kept talking about their honour being tainted. So I started to think they want me to go because I'm brought so much shame upon my family. And I felt ashamed of my own self for being raped, which is a ridiculous thing to say, but it's how a lot of victims feel. And it's how I felt that I put myself in that position. It was my fault. I'm an idiot. Look at me. Nobody wants me. You know, I'm this bad person. So I tried to take my life, which didn't work, with an overdose. And that led them to then try to find a solution to the problem. And the problem was called Nina. And one of the people came forward, as I said, I called him uncle, but he wasn't related at all. He was actually one of the main people from the religious section of our local temple. So he was very well respected. He was known in the community. My father was known in the community too. So they were both really respected. And who would believe me, even if I did decide to talk out? So I was going along with whatever they were telling me to do. And to cut a long story short, I was engaged to that person's son because his son had an English girlfriend and the community were asking questions. So they told me I would marry him. And I've not said this before, but we both went to the same college because I was allowed to go to college for 1 year. I did my A-levels in 1 year. And I was 17, I was 16, sorry, just coming up to 17. And, you know, I knew that I was going to marry him. And I tried to talk to him once, thinking I'm going to marry him. But he took me one day to a side and said, I wanted to go for a walk with you. And I thought, oh, you know, we're going to get married. He's going to take me for a walk. We're going to have a discussion. And he wanted to tell me that he had no intention of doing anything with me, that he had a girlfriend, told me the girl's name, said that his parents have told him to stop seeing her. He'll never stop seeing her. So when I get married, I'm not getting married because we're going to have a relationship. It'll never happen. And I was quite heartbroken because I thought, what's really going to happen then? You know, what's the intention here? At home, there was a big argument going on about what they had to pay this man to stay quiet, to take me off their hands. And the wedding happened very quickly because I was literally 16, 17 when it happened. But even the girl that I spoke to the other day said it all happened very quickly. And we were all very confused because 1 minute somebody said it was a love marriage, then the other person said, no, it was forced upon you. You know, we didn't know what was happening. But suddenly you'd gone and you were married. And then we never saw you again. And it was a way of them keeping the secret under wraps, you know, underground. Nobody would know about the rape. It was also a way of that man controlling my father financially. He was able to say to him, my father, who was quite wealthy, he'd created his own wealth, that I want thousands of pounds from you and I want all of this gold. And my father literally traded. He sold me to him to keep the secret quiet, but also sold me knowing that I would be used as a sexual object and a slave, a modern day slave in the new house I would go to. So the marriage was a sham marriage. It wasn't normal. I was downstairs. They all slept upstairs. I had a room downstairs. It was like a servant quarters. And my job was literally to cook for them. My in-laws were exceptionally mean to me. They were, you know, being at home to me felt better than it would have been in this place because the house was so small. I felt very almost suffocating with being around them. I was used to having my big room and my own little books and things. Suddenly I was being told to go to work. I had two jobs then. I've not said that before either. And I ended up earning a really good amount of money. But at my second job, I met these people and he was Nigerian. She was Indian, Punjabi like me. And she said, you know what? You shouldn't be living like this. You come to work, your ankles are bleeding. You've got bite marks. You've got scratches. What's going on? And I thought because she's like me, a girl like me, a brown girl from a culture like mine, maybe she'll get it. Because I was kind of scared of no one believing me. And she believed me straight away. She told me I should leave the house, not go back, go to my parents, that they'd look after me. And I was like, well, Her parents weren't very nice to me, but I couldn't tell her that I'd been raped because that was, again, a shameful secret I was carrying, and I was too scared to tell anybody because if somebody found out of our family, it would be all hell would break loose. So I kept it quiet as I was told to. But my father-in-law was doing some really weird and horrible things to me. He was tying me up with a metal coat hanger, and the metal coat hangers in those days were very quite sturdy. So when he would wrap them around my ankles, the sharp edges would cut into my ankles and I couldn't move. It was a way to keep me still. And he would go off for the whole day and he would strip me and leave me there in a way of humiliating me, but also he kind of got a kick out of the control aspect. So I would soil myself. I wouldn't be able to move. You know, if I even moved a slight inch, my ankle would bleed and it would dig into my ankles. And it was a real traumatic time for me because I was just being treated with such a kind of strange kind of violent abuse, I guess is the word. But my mother-in-law was equally as abusive with her ways of degrading me and making me feel like I wasn't worth anything. You know, she would often just poke me when I was walking past. She would, if I plated food for myself, because I had a really bad relationship with food, if I plated myself a meal, and I've said this before, and it really upsets me, but she would literally throw the plate in the bin and then tell me to eat out of the bin and say that I was like a dog and that it wasn't my father's home, that I didn't deserve to eat. And if I didn't eat out of the bin, she would start to get a rolling pin and really sort of hit me with it. So I had to almost eat out of it, even though I didn't want to. So I stopped plating myself food because I just was desperately feeling humiliated and mistreated, I guess, by her too. And it got to a point where I really didn't want to be there. I was tired of smiling to people and pretending this was my life. You know, if I had to go to a function, I would often be dancing and, you know, doing the Indian thing, and people would be like, she's so happy. And I really wasn't. And that whole mask was just slowly but surely falling off. And I ended up at 21, ended up deciding that I wasn't staying any longer. And I ended up at my parents' house. And that's where things got worse, really.
It's so difficult because if you're in a cult or a religion, it's not easy, but you can maybe leave that cult. But this is your family and you're sort of dependent, I suppose, on them at that point. How did you get out from there?
I did go back to my mum's house, my dad's house, you know, and I have to admit, when I got off the bus and saw my house, I felt home again. You know, I desperately wanted to go back in my room, sit with my books and go back to my old life, even though it wasn't a good life. It was a better life than what I was living. I was being continuously raped by my father-in-law as well. And I just wanted to get away from that physical sexual abuse because I didn't like it. I just didn't like being held down or pulling his hands out of my clothes. I just didn't like how I was living. And I just wanted to go back to being a kid, looking after my family the way I thought I was looking after them. And when I went in the house, my father, he opened the door and he was really angry. He knew I was coming. He grabbed me by my hair and dragged me into my, you know, into the front room, as we call it. And that's where I was raped. And I instantly started having flashbacks. And I said to myself, because I've had this habit since I've been a child of talking to myself, this internal dialogue goes in, I still do it. But I was saying to myself, what have you done? You know, what have you just done? And they started to beat me. When I say they, it was my father and my eldest brother, who was 7 years older than me. But, you know, just to paint a picture, I was a 21-year-old who was probably anorexic, who was small for her age, and her father was an ex-professional wrestler. My brother was 6 foot tall. You know, Punjabi people are quite sturdy built. You know, they're not... they're known for being strong and tall, and they definitely were. And they started with punching. They started telling me I was a prostitute, that I'd let myself down, I'd let the family down, that people would laugh at them, that they would never be able to go out of the house, that my father would have a heart attack, that all my relatives would spit upon him out of shame. And those words were really heavy. But with those words, they were furious. That's the only way I can describe it. And they were punching me. And when I fell to the floor, my jaw had already been broken by my brother. My arm had been broken by him. And when I fell to the floor, they started to stamp me. And they were kicking and stamping. And with that, they were saying things. And my mother was stood watching with her arms crossed, because I sort of looked up slowly and sheepishly, scared to look up. But I needed someone to help me. And my other brother's wife, she was stood there and she seemed angry too. And nobody seemed to have compassion. It was almost like I deserved this beating. And I'd been beaten lots of times, believe me. I was used to being beaten, but this wasn't a beating of teaching a lesson. It was to kill. That was the intention. They had no other intention. And my father held his foot against my throat, to a point where I believe I died, because I remember almost looking at myself from the outside and I saw this really crumpled up little girl, lifeless. And I remember a voice, or my own voice possibly, saying, "Not yet, it's not your time yet." And I went back into that body and was numb. That's the only way I can describe it. I felt numb. I felt cold, very cold. And I remember watching the blood drip off my face, like my tears are falling now onto my end of my nose, and they would go into the carpet. And I remember thinking, I really don't like this carpet. And then my other brother came and they all just walked straight out. They left me because he said, "You can't kill her here. We'll take her to India and we'll finish her off there." And it was like they were exhausted from hitting me. They were physically exhausted. I remember their labored breath. You know, they were struggling because they were putting everything into this force when they would hit me, that they almost seemed relieved to be having a break. But that break that they took gave me time to obviously realize I was completely broken physically. They had broken bones. There was not one part of my skin that wasn't ripped or covered with a bruise or a, you know, there were bones protruding from my arm. It was just, I looked, the only way I can describe it is that I looked like something out of a horror film. And I've used that phrase before, because that's how, if I see a film, I see myself. And that's who I was. And after a few days, somebody, an aunt, my mum's friend again, you know, we call her auntie, said, "They're going to take you to India. You need to ask for help at the airport." And I thought, I haven't got that courage. I can't do that. If my dad's standing next to me, I'm going to be too scared to say, "Help me." I don't think people understand how hard it is to ask for help, but it's so hard. So I decided, again, my internal dialogue, "Nina, what do you want to do? Do you want to live or die?" And Nina wanted to live. I don't know why. There was no reason to live, to be honest with you, but I wanted to. And I had a rebirth, I feel. I tried like a baby to crawl. I couldn't do it. So I shuffled on the fronts of my arms, my forearms, and got to the door. And I broke this really big, difficult, impossible task down to three parts. I told myself, I can get to this door in this room and open the door, I'm nearly there. If I can get to the other side of the kitchen, I'll be in the garden. And if I can get to the garden, I'll be free. And I said to myself, "You can do this." And I kept saying it to myself. And I would fall and I would cry silently because I couldn't cry out loud. And the house was full of these angry people. But I knew when my mum's friend came, they were busy for a few hours. They would watch an Indian film or something. So I knew I had this time. And I made it to the kitchen and to the garden as I thought I could. And when I got to the garden, I forgot my dad had this huge fence he'd built. It was a 6-foot-tall fence. And I thought, now this is impossible. There's no way I can get over this fence with my broken body. I can't physically do it. And there's two things to this part of the story. And the first is that we need encouragement from somebody, somewhere, sometimes, a sign. And I believe in the universe, and the universe saved me. And I believe the universe sent my dog to remind me that I could do it. And my dog, she would always bark. Even the girl that rang me the other day said, you know, your dog used to always bark. Girl's name's Rita. And my dog sat next to me and she just looked at me. And I remember touching her wet nose and begging her, saying, please don't bark. Please don't bark because I'll die right now. Please don't bark. They'll be here. They'll come out. They'll hear you. And she didn't bark. But she looked up. She looked up at that fence and she looked straight at me. And I felt that was a sign. And the second thing is that I believed I then could do it because someone had encouraged me and I believed I could do it. And I did it. And when I fell on the other side of the fence, I managed to crawl to a park, which was across the road. And I passed out there until I managed to get free.
Oh my God. And then where can you even go? You've got nowhere to go at this point.
Well, I had my friends who had said to me to leave, you know, the couple that had told me to go. I had their address. They'd imprinted it in my head. I'd memorized it. So I got to a taxi place and the guy said to me, someone after you, you need to go to hospital. I said, no, it's my family. It's cultural. And he was really kind. And I call him one of my angels. You know, I believe they've come in my path more than once. He took me to my friends who didn't open the door. And then he took me to a police station where I stood having photos taken of me. And the police officer saying to me, do you want to press charges, and writing a report? And before the end of the report, he said, tell me exactly what happened. And I mistakenly, not knowing at the time, said it was an attempted honour killing. If I'd said it was an attempted murder, which is what it was, you know, we would have pressed charges and he would have helped me to do that. But because I used a cultural word, he didn't really want to be involved because he didn't understand it. And people shy away from things they don't understand. So he sent me to a hospital where I stayed for 2 months. I stayed in the hospital for 2 months, and every time somebody would come in, they would pick my file up and throw it down because there was a sticky note on there saying honour killing attempt. And the cultural thing, you know, no one questioned, whereas your family, no nurse asked me how I was feeling or if I wanted to tell them anything. No doctor stopped long enough to, you know, really look at me and find out what was going on. I was almost healing without care in a hospital. And this is in early 1990s, 1991. So it was not a million, you know, it's not like a million years ago. But there was no care given. The care system let me down horrendously. And when I came out of there, they sent me to a women's refuge, which was full of women who were addicted to alcohol or drug substances, which I could not understand and I could not cope with because they were aggressive. They were dancing with their own demons and I didn't want to be part of their dance. So being the scared little girl I was, I said to the lady, that the warden, I said, I want to get to my friend's house. And she gave me some money and I was another problem off their case, and they were able to offer that bed to somebody else. Again, that person should have stopped and asked me questions. They didn't. They just wanted to get rid of me.
Well, was the feeling that the police and the doctors and things were more scared? Were they scared of offending a culture or of being attacked by your family or something if they helped you too much?
Being the activist that I am, I still speak out about this. I've stood at Scotland Yard. I've spoken at, you know, headquarters of certain police areas. And I'm speaking in a conference coming up as well in June to 1,000 delegates. But let me tell you, when I've spoken at places, they listen because I'm a survivor and I'm telling my story. But I will probably get one out of 30, 40 people come to me and say, what can I do to change this? I've even sat at Scotland Yard and I'm not doing anything. I'm not breaking the law because I don't believe that we should be so scared of the authorities. They're here to protect and serve us. I've sat in a meeting last month and first thing I said at the meeting was, I don't like the police. And the very high up officer sat next to me laughed and I told him not to laugh. And what he should have done was said, how can I change that? How can I change your opinion? Because you're representing your community in this meeting. How can I give you faith? So things haven't changed over the last 30, 40 years with the police. They see it as a cultural problem. They see it as messy. They don't know how to deal with it. When I go into the police stations, I tick a box that they've had somebody come in. But do they care? No, because there's no compassion. The first thing they ask a victim of an attempted honour killing is, if they're underage, they'll go and speak to the parents. They don't think about safeguarding that child by saying, we're going to remove this kid until we know what's going on. The parents in the meantime will go and take the child, send them to India or send them to Pakistan or wherever it is, the Middle East, and that kid's gone and they can't bring them back because nobody could bring my sister back. So do I feel let down by the police? Yes. Do I trust the police? No. Do I think the police are making changes? No. Do I hold them accountable? Yes, because we pay for the services for them to protect and service, and they have never once protected or served me.
Well, there is more to your story, but just we're running low on time. And I think maybe the most important thing from what you've just said is how can we help then? And how can my listeners and my viewers on YouTube, what can they do if they want to help?
Yeah, I mean, if they want to find out more about me, they can find me anywhere. I'm sure there's lots of places they can find me, but I run a nonprofit. I run the nonprofit to serve others, and I don't close my doors to anyone. You know, my cult, in my religion rather, we believe we're all one. So if anybody's out there struggling, whether they're male, female, it doesn't make a difference. If they've had anything traumatic happen to them, get in contact with them. I run a monthly, like a drop-in clinic so that you can come and speak to us. I have other people helping me, but more so know that if you're going through something that's bad, you've got to keep going because it's a life lesson and you have to go through it to grow from it, I guess. And I've grown into this person that I have to say I completely love. And it doesn't matter if nobody else loves me because I know how much love I have now within that I can extend to everyone around me.
Thank you, Nina Ulk, for being so brave, so courageous, so generous with your time and for sharing all of that with us. And I do hope that anyone who was able to listen through that was enlightened a bit about the evils in this world and the horrible things that humans sometimes do. As I say, you know, I'll only direct you to those links that should be in the show notes now about how you can help her and people like her, people who were in situations like hers. And thank you for being there, for supporting my guests, everybody. Thanks for listening. And there'll be another episode out in a few days.